Here at Fresh Air, we use personal computers to keep track of guests and to write our scripts, but there are far more powerful computers now designed for desktop use. These computers, the size of a pizza box, are called personal workstations, or in the jargon of Silicon Valley, hot boxes because of their power and speed. My guest today, Bill Joy, is the Vice President of Research and Development at Sun Microsystems, a $2 billion company he helped start 7 years ago. Sun is in the forefront of the development of workstations, which are able to create 3D images of body tissue, predict complex traffic flows, generate special effects for movies, and design other microchips, future offspring, if you will, for even more advanced computers. The software that makes these boxes of molded plastic and silicon behave is called the operating system, and these machines run Unix, spelled U-N-I-X. As a student at UC Berkeley, Bill Joy helped create a Unix system able to use software from a variety of computer companies, and this open standard is forcing other computer companies to change the way they do business. Instead of guarding their inventions, they must share information in order to survive. Bill Joy, now 34, advocates open and accessible computer products. I asked him about proprietary interests computer companies hold and his own approach to designing a new machine.
Unix always existed in a community where people just shared what they'd done, and people could build on other people's work. So you could take somebody else's stuff and modify a little bit and resend it out, and people would just sort of freely interchange their tapes and their information. Whereas in the larger computer industry, we see people suing each other, and we see intellectual property laws that were written hundreds of years ago that were long before the ideas of patents and so forth that weren't designed to maximize anything in particular that works well for software. So it's difficult to understand how in an industry where you generally build on other people's work, if people protect all the pieces, how you can make very rapid progress. So we have a real dilemma in computing. And Unix is an example of a system which exists because a different kind of culture, a non-commercial sharing sort of culture, allowed people to build on each other's work. And I think that's a good a really good thing, and unfortunately it's not the general practice in the industry.
Which is curious, because I think most of the novel developments have always come from outsiders or individuals working in a garage or a basement that somehow are rejected or ignored by large corporations, and so the developer goes off and starts her or his own company to do it.
Yeah, I think historically in the computer industry, before there was a computer industry, it was really physicists who did all the, invented all the neat machines to track the missiles or, ballistic shells in World War II or whatever. They always had very brilliant insights and a lot of ability to go and build things out of gears and all sorts of, early vacuum tubes and so forth. And even more recently, the sort of Silicon Valley culture of, the hacker in the garage building things. It's been sort of rugged individualism, but it's getting to be a big business now with the emergence of the distribution channels and the mass marketing and things like Lotus and brand name identification. So I think it's getting harder and harder to really do that.
My guest is Bill Joy, computer programmer and computer planner and thinker. Why is compatibility and connectivity so appealing to you as somebody who uses them?
If you could imagine the phone system in the country where you couldn't call people from one phone at another location unless you had the right color telephone, all the black phones could only talk to the black phones, and the red phones could only talk to the red phones. You could imagine how frustrating it would be wandering around a building looking for the right kind of phone, and people trying to get their work done using computers face that every day, where they have the wrong kind of software. It won't plug in and it just won't work. Or if you had six different voltages of electricity in your house and your appliances could only plug in certain rooms, that's the level of frustration that people face in computing today. And it's extremely unappealing. Not only that, once you go to the trouble of building an application, a piece of software to do something, and then you discover that the PC you're running on isn't powerful enough and you need to run it on a bigger computer to really get your job done, you discover that they have a totally different software, so that you have to start over again. And that's just not very satisfying. It's very frustrating for people, and it really prevents people from doing a lot of things. So the ability to move your software between different kinds of machines is very important, and especially to move them to larger machines when your problem outgrows the machine that you're running on. You know, you can't always move yourself in your car. Sometimes you need a truck. And it's nice to know there's sort of a vehicle that has the same characteristics. You know, it drives on the same roads and so forth. And that's what larger computers that run Unix are compatible with smaller ones.
But clearly this idea of connectivity and compatibility is appealing only to some people in the computer business. There are some, as business people, who've felt the idea of having a proprietary computer design with proprietary software so that you can't buy the software without the computer and the computer with the software has made sense for them. But as a, but that's a different attitude than that of a pure sort of computer whiz.
Yeah, well, you know, 25 years ago when they introduced punch cards, people had big arguments about how if everybody used the same kind of punch cards, then that would be the end of the world in the computer industry. And people were arguing about whether round holes in the cards or square holes in the cards were the right thing. And I think what you find is that the truth of the matter is that we've only begun to do what we, with computers, the things that we can do. There's plenty of things for companies to do to make help their customers solve their problems, and to get stuck at any point in the creation of the system and say, I have to have this and it's going to be totally unique to me, is very appealing from a business standpoint because your customers can't change. It's as though once you bought a Ford, you'd have to buy a Ford for the rest of your life. But it's just not something that's going to stick. And, you know, it's like the old Machiavelli quote about how difficult it is to introduce a new order of things. Every time some sort of change occurs in the industry, everybody resists. But there's too much technological progress laying around the industry to prevent things from going forward. Technology is just, you know, doubling in capability and halving in cost every couple of years, and it's just unprecedented. That's the unique nature of the technological revolution. And you just can't box it up. It just won't be boxed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are companies in the East, in the Boston area, along Route 128, some that started in the late 50s and mid-60s, like Digital and Wang and Data General, that are finding themselves being superseded by companies now in Silicon Valley, such as yours. Do you think much about the implications of people being laid off and looking for new work elsewhere as the result of these developments, or is this just something that goes along with the business?
Well, I suppose the most frightening thing for us is the prospect that all the jobs will go overseas. And I think what we've seen in the last couple of years in the computer industry here is a much more competitive environment. And I think, you know, the advent of Unix has had something to do with that. And I think this has basically woken a lot of the computer companies up, so people are working much harder to deliver to their customers what the machines are really capable of. And I think if we'd stayed in the sort of proprietary lethargy that we were in before, the computer industry itself was very vulnerable to foreign competition, where the rules would have been changed, and we just suddenly woke up, I think, like the automakers woke up with a real problem on our hands, a real quality, competitive, price performance, whatever sort of a problem. And so while some of the companies in the U.S. are clearly haven't adapted to this new environment, I think by and large, it's mostly U.S. companies that are at the forefront of these new developments, and I think that bodes well for our economy. It's more of a churning, probably, of jobs as opposed to a layoff in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And technology industries tend to be very volatile. Companies are created and destroyed at a very rapid rate. Apple, you know, didn't exist, you know, just a few years ago, and it's a very significant player. Sun also in the computer industry now. So that the names change, but the players remain the same. We like to say, you know, Silicon Valley is like all the companies are like different pews in a church, and people move between the pews. But it's really sort of one big company, in a sense, because we're all sharing the talent pool that exists here in the valley.
There's been a lot of comment about the intense lifestyle, the long hours, the pressure, the burnout, the stress. Has this affected you in some way? Have you been able to avoid it over the past several years?
I think I'm doing a better job of handling it now than I did a few years ago. It's clearly nothing as exciting as having a real challenging problem in front of you, and the computer never gets tired. It just sits there, and so you can work until the wee hours of the morning. But I think that's the kind of challenge that we all look for. And, you know, having had a few successes, some of the projects I've worked on, I find it easier now to take time between. But it's the Silicon Valley lifestyle is kind of wearing a lot of people down. And, you know, the growth in the area is the traffic problems and all are getting much, much worse. And so I think we have to worry about these in the next decade.
Were you drawn to computers at an early age? I mean, I think what you were a chess player, weren't you?
As a child, yeah. And I actually wanted to be in mathematics, but I got to college, and programming was sort of addictive, and so I ended up spending my time at the computer center instead of in classes, and so it became sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy then to be in the computing industry.
Can you explain a bit about that, the nature of the addiction of being a computer programmer?
I think the thing is that you have an idea, and you start to translate it into the machine code, and you know what the thing is supposed to do. And if you have the determination to try to make it work, it becomes a battle. Like, it's like winning a chess game or something. You have to sit there and struggle, because the machine is checking and will tell you whether you've done the right thing. It's an, you know, sort of an unerring opponent and a tireless opponent. And there's a great satisfaction with finishing it and actually getting it to do what you thought. And it's a little different than most other things, because the computer is sort of a faultless judge. You know, there's no question that your thing is right or wrong, and so that's kind of a nice non-subjective sort of evaluation you get from the machine. But it does take an enormous amount of time, because you know, one mistake in the program, and the whole thing just falls apart. It's a little bit like genetics or something. You know, there's, you know, you need millions or billions of base pairs, and just a couple little things in there that are wrong can create huge disasters. So it's a very painstaking process, and there's a great sense of victory when you actually get the thing to work.
Have you ever felt so frustrated by being around computers that you'd like to go, in the words of one other computer programmer, to where the longest moment of time you had to deal with was a season rather than a nanosecond?
Yeah, the pace of the thing gets to you after a while. It can be incredibly frustrating when you're looking for something which lasts about a nanosecond and which is causing this thing which you've worked on for a very long time to not work. And I think there's definitely a limited span to the amount of time that someone can be productive in this field, like advertising perhaps, or other industries where people burn out. I think the real phenomenon here, though, is that we're about to have our first generation of kids who grew up with computers. And, you know, if there's programming Bach's and Beethoven's, they're going to be the kids who grew up with computers in elementary school and high school and so forth. And those kids, maybe you could call them Apple kids or whatever, are just about probably to hit the workforce now. And I think I'm a pretty good programmer, but I suspect I can't compete with even the second rank of these kids. There's going to be some really, truly outstanding people who can go out and use computers to solve really hard problems and make the world a better place among these kids. And that, I'm looking forward to seeing what they do. It's going to be great fun to watch over the next 10 years. And hopefully some of the great software they write will run on some of the hardware that our company has built.
You know, I've been interested in the idea of our accelerating pace of time with the computers, with fax machines, jet travel, and clearly our nervous systems are accelerating as well, it seems. And it'll be interesting to see how these kids are evolved.
You know? I think our nervousness is accelerating. Fax machines, newspapers, magazines. I mean, if you pile all that stuff up that you get and it gets dumped on you, it's like you have to struggle to have time to read a book. And this goes back to your comment about the seasons. I find it very distressing. I recently canceled my subscriptions to all the newspapers I subscribe to, just to try to clear the input somewhat, you know. And the fax machines are incredibly insistent. There's no time for reflection between writing something and sending it. And We're essentially being driven into a post-industrial frenzy here, and it's really not very good. People knew about this at the turn of the century, but that this was coming, we have to get control of our lives a little bit here. We're being marketed to everywhere we go. You get on an airplane and you're basically watching an infomercial. It's really frustrating when you realize what's being done to you.
You are treated as a guru, as a wizard in the computer business. As you're in your position as a vice president of research and development, do you get to just kind of go out and talk with people about how they use computers? Can you sit and put your feet up and just think about 15 years down the computer line? Is this the essence of your work?
I generally try to talk to people who are sort of leading edge people and to think a few years ahead, because it's so difficult to change what's going to happen in 3 years, because everything that's going to be available in 3 years, like in cars, all those systems in generally are underway already, and to go in and make any difference, you have to go in and disrupt things, which is makes the things take 5 years instead of 3 years. And so I tend to work near the horizon. And there are a lot of bright people scattered around the world who for whatever reason, can see over the horizon a bit. Those are the people you want to talk to. And I do enjoy traveling and meeting these people, whether they're doing 3D glasses that you wear and walk around in a simulated universe, or they're composing computer music, or, finding new ways for children to learn music using electronics or whatever. It's really exciting, and they always have an incredible amount of enthusiasm for what they're doing, and it's just fun to be around them.
I'd like to go back, if I could, to the issue of compatibility and connectivity. A lot of other companies have expressed an interest in the microchips that you have developed that will allow this sort of greater range of compatibility. How is that working out on the corporate structure? Is there resentment by those companies that aren't yet a part of the deal that you've made with other corporations?
I think the industry is in a state of relative hysteria right now, and it has become very politicized. And everybody feels like on all these issues, like which chip are you using, or are you for Unix, or are you against Unix? People want to know the answers, even if they don't understand the question. That's just what's in the air these days. And so it becomes a question everybody asks, even if the answer isn't that critical. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it becomes a litmus test. It's like, are you pro choice or pro whatever? And people get confused about which is which.
Is this leading to a less competitive situation where companies will be inclined to share more information? Will it break down the proprietary interests of an IBM or a Data General?
I think what happens is that if you get enough of these choices, let's say they have to choose which operating system to use, they have to choose which processor chip to use, they have to choose which style of user interface to use, they have to choose several other things, and there are five things, and For each of these five things, there's three choices, two of which are safe and one of which is a disaster. The odds of you being able to choose all five, if you choose randomly, you're likely to get one of them wrong. And the price of being wrong is very high these days, because the technology is moving so quickly. And you can't adapt. If you make a bad evolutionary choice, you can't adapt very well. So a lot of these companies historically have just looked to do what IBM does, but IBM tends to do many things, and it's very difficult for anyone else to be successful by doing what they do, because that means you're always behind them, and so the necessity of you making the right choices about these individual five things is very is very high. You really have to have people around who think hard about these things and make the right choices. You have to choose for Unix. You have to choose to do microprocessors. You have to choose to do computers that interface to people well. You have to, and you have to have made investments in these things, because there's only a fixed number of people on the planet in each of these areas who knows how to do those things well. And if you don't get at least a few of those people in your company, then your ability to really work on that is going to be very limited. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard choices. There's no easy answer here, and the questions keep popping up, and you just have to keep making good choices.
As the research person, do you ever find yourself in absolute catacorners talking with the business people of your company?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very easy for people to find business reasons to argue either side of an issue. And the smarter the people are, the faster they can do that. And the most difficult thing is to argue with someone whose approach to decision-making is a totally irrational one, because facts are so misleading. You really have to emotionally believe in what you're doing in order to be successful. And so rationality is not enough. Spreadsheets are not good ways of making decisions when situations are as complicated as they are. They tend to give two-dimensional answers, and the problems are multidimensional.
I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air.
Okay, thank you.